From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with two former cops who were busted for corruption, then informed on the other corrupt members of the precinct. We'll also be joined by the reporter who covered the scandal and wrote a new book about it called Buddy Boys. Also today, I speak with black South African jazz singer Sadama B. Benjamin. She had to leave her country to pursue her career. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews A Quiet Place, Leonard Bernstein's opera that picks up 30 years after his first opera, Trouble in Tahiti, leaves off. And humorist Al Gingold reveals the true measure of an adult. Not job, not income, not type of car, but that first sofa you buy. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Officers Henry Winter and Tony Magno used to be partners in Brooklyn's 77th Precinct in the high-crime neighborhoods of Bedford-Stuyvesant and Crown Heights. While fighting crime, Winter and Magno became criminals. They pocketed the money and fenced the drugs they confiscated during busts. In 1986, Winter and Magno were busted. They were given the option of facing long prison sentences or cooperating with the authorities by giving evidence of other corrupt cops in the precinct. They cooperated and agreed to wear wires to record incriminating conversations with fellow officers. As a result, 13 cops were indicted. One of them committed suicide. Winter and Magno were transferred to the Internal Affairs Headquarters, but they were both asked to resign last Thursday, and they did. Henry Winter and Tony Magno are my guests, along with Mike McAlary, the author of a new book about this police corruption scandal called Buddy Boys. McAlary covered this scandal for New York Newsday. I want to welcome you all to Fresh Air.
Hello.
Mike, let me ask you first, as a journalist, you were covering the story before you wrote the book.
Yes.
Do you think a police corruption story looks different as you get deeper into it? We all have our ideas of what police corruption is like, but as you get really close to the story, as you really get to know the cops who are involved, as you have for the story and for this book, does the story start to change?
Well, it becomes more of a human thing. This was about people who might have had some character flaws existing that I'm not sure ever would have stepped over the line had they not been in a place like the Brooklyn 77th Precinct, which was basically a dumping ground for the department, for cops who were discipline problems, duty shirkers, drinkers, cops who were trouble but not quite trouble enough to be fired. And they weren't supervised, and so they were banding together, and they went out and they became a citizen's worst nightmare. They became the criminals themselves.
I want to ask you both, Tony and Henry, to tell a little bit about what the story was like. Let me start by asking you, the first things that you did that you thought of that you knew were wrong and corrupt, the first time you took money, for instance, or took something while you were on the beat. Henry, can we start with you?
You mean Tony, right?
Did I say Henry? Yeah.
Well, you talk about any type of corruption. Could be a free cup of coffee, something like that. Well, that started right away in my career, because when I came on prior to the Knapp Commission. And as a rookie, the older officers would go out to certain stores. You know, they'd ask you, you want anything? You know, I'd say, give me this or give me that. And they would, you know, I'd try to give them money. They said, don't worry about it. And eventually I learned that those particular stores you go in and you didn't have to pay for anything.
And everybody did that?
At that time, yeah. You know, nobody really blinked an eye at that time for something like that. Most people, I think, realized that cops, you know, did that. They went into stores, and the store owners treated them what they would call good, you know.
Henry?
Basically the same, fresh out of the academy, working up in a 2-5 precinct. You go into a store, a location, the owner of the bodega is glad to see you. Could be a lonely night, a rainy night. Doesn't want to be alone. You know, invite you in. Officer, come on in. You know, you want a cup of coffee? You know, and you sit down, you're talking to him, you take your cigarettes and your coffee.
Okay, now this really escalated. It got to the point where you were busting drug dealers and keeping the drugs and fencing the drugs.
Right.
And taking the money. How would that work? How would you do it?
Well, the way it worked, there was a group of us in the 77 precinct. We called ourselves the Body Boys. We would put out a code over the air, and we would stage false calls to our locations. We call it dropping a dime. Somebody would drop a dime report of a man with a gun at a drug location, and we would go back into the car, wait for the call to come over. Once it came over, we'd answer our own call, and we'd go into the location and remove drugs, money, whatever was there. By us going to the location, 9 out of 10 times, the person jumped out the back window, leaving the drugs, leaving the money.
Why did you have to place a call? Why couldn't you just go in? Why did you have to have this code?
Well, the code that we used, Buddy Boys, that was to meet initially, and we discussed what we were going to do.
Uh-huh.
The dropping the dime was done on occasion, but usually if it was a quiet night, we just scout around. If it was a busy location for drugs, we'll say, okay, let's try this place. And that's what we did. Like, two would go to the front, the other two would go to the back. You'd hit the door hard in the front, you know, just to scare them. And the two other officers in the back will be waiting by a window. And whoever was dealing would jump out, you know, hopefully with the goods in their hand, and you catch them right there, and you remove the property from them.
So the point was, you'd make it seem as if they were getting away, even though you were trying to nab them. But really,
yes,
you were letting them get away so that you could...
That's correct.
Correct.
Take,
that was
take
it.
The drugs.
Right.
And then did the cops use the drugs or just sell the drugs?
There were some cops that were using drugs. Most of the drugs were given to another officer who... had friends with a drug dealer, and they was sold back to this drug dealer for resale on the street.
That's when me and my partner really became what we considered, you know, low, because at one point it was bad enough we crossed the line when we started taking money. And then when it got to the point when we hooked up with, you know, two of the officers that had a connection with a drug dealer, before that we were just taking money. They would take drugs, and I used to think that they were going to get rid of them or voucher them. They turned it into a drug dealer that they knew and got half of what the street value was worth. And a couple of days later, they would give us the money. And that's when I really felt like there was something wrong, because that was totally against everything I believed in. It was bad enough taking money, but the drug end of it was terrible.
Let me reintroduce you. I'm speaking with Tony Magno and Henry Winter, two ex-cops in New York at the 77th Precinct, who helped expose a police corruption scandal that they were involved in themselves. Also with me is Mike McAlary, who's written, who's covered this for Newsday and wrote a new book about it called Buddy Boys. Now, you had this code set up. You knew all the other cops who were in on this. How does one cop find out if another cop is corrupt or willing to participate in this kind of ring? How do you feel someone out? How do you know?
Well, it's not something that you ask them. You know, you might be on a working a late tour or whatever tour it is, and it might be a burglary at a location. You would respond, and then you'd maybe have a backup unit. And as you're there, you know, the cops would come up, and they'd be taking batteries, taking cigarettes, taking sodas, they'd be putting stuff in their pocket. And just by being there, and you not saying something, or them seeing you take something, and by not saying something, you knew they'd be all right.
Okay.
That's that blue wall of silence that still exists and went up as soon as this case was over and is back in place firmly now in the New York City Police Department.
Is it?
That was a hard part of this whole thing when we started investigating.
I want to get back to how you rationalized doing it. During the days when you were confiscating money and drugs, fencing the drugs, what was your rationalization for letting the offenders get away and for selling the stuff yourself?
Well, originally, the way it started, Tony and I would go into a location. We'd catch the drug dealer. I would burn their money. I would put a clump of money together, no matter what it was. I'd burn it.
Why would you do that?
Because the way the system worked, you would lock someone up. You would bring him to jail, bring him to central booking, then arraignment. He'd pay a $50 fine, a $100 fine, and be out on the street the next day waving at you. And it was like a kick in the pants. Here I am, you know, taking this guy, bringing him into court. And it's a revolving door. He goes in one door and out the other door. The way I was rationalizing it was, I'm hurting him now. You know, I can't hurt him in his pocket because all he's doing is paying a $100 fine. He's making $2,000-$3,000 a day. That doesn't hurt him. By burning his money and making him flush his drugs, I was hurting him.
And that escalated to keeping his money and keeping his drugs.
That went to keeping his money after that and then taking his drugs and, you know, selling it.
And your rationale for that was?
There wasn't. It was just something that we got involved in and just part how it just escalated into it.
Now, the temptation was always there, you know, for years. You know, you'd be going into the same type of locations, and these locations were getting more numerous as each month went by. And you could go down a block and pass 10 to 12 locations just on one block. And half the times you go in there, and the same thing, the temptation is there. They jump out the window, there's stuff left. And you used to do the right thing at one time. You voucher it, plus the money and the drugs.
You know,
and it just, you know, it just took something, maybe a little peer pressure or whatever the case may be, and always that money right in front of you. That one time you took that $1, next time $2. Before you know it, you're taking most of the money. Then it got to the point where you dealt with other cops that were able to get rid of drugs, and now you were into actually taking the drugs to a drug dealer and getting half of that profit.
You know, and what Tony said is, you know, as the places were just popping up left and right, Tony and I worked a sector that maybe was 7 to 8 blocks, square blocks. We had approximately 37 drug locations in our sector, plus number locations, illegal OTB parlors. And the cop in New York City, a uniform cop on patrol, it was not supposed to enter these locations. You can't, your hands are tied. If you entered the locations, the supervisors had to fill out a report, had to go to the borough. The supervisor would tell you, don't enter that location. You see drugs, leave it alone. Don't do anything. You know, it's your hands are tied.
You were both busted for...
Yes, just taking money.
For taking money,
okay. Right. And then you were given the option of facing this long prison sentence or cooperating with the authorities and turning evidence on your fellow officers. Now, you decided to cooperate. I'm sure you spent a lot of time,
sleepless
you probably didn't
nights.
Have that much time to spend, but you spent a lot of energy, like, figuring out what you were going to do and deciding which was the better decision to make. What tipped the scales for you in favor of cooperating? Was there...
My family and my kids. That's what tipped my scale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a hard thing for a cop, like Mike said before, with this... every cop knows there's this blue wall of silence. You just don't turn another cop in. You see what he does, you close your eyes, you walk away. With this, it wasn't where we were given in cops. It was much more involved than that because, you know...
These were personal friends.
Tony's been there for 17 years. I was there for, 7 years. These were friends that we gave up. It was a big decision.
Not saying what we were doing was right and what they were doing were right in the street. You know, we can't just ever justify what we did was right, you know, taking anything like that or them. But the decision to, you know, give up friends was, it was a terrible, experience mentally, physically, emotionally. And it just got worse and worse as we were out there. And there was really nobody to turn to because you were under the pressure of the state prosecutor who you were cooperating with, also an internal affairs division. And when you're asked to cooperate, you also have to tell them everything that you've ever done in your career. Like we were just caught just taking, like I said, money. Now me and my partner had to admit, like we told you before, when we got that first cup of coffee, right down the line. And I'll tell you, what we're doing on this tour is not justifying anything. It's just trying to show how two good cops could just go over that edge and turn out to be bad. You know, after all the good that you did, you could ruin a whole career, your family, friends, you have nobody. And Mike, who we met when we had nobody to turn to, actually did a great, great job in telling a true story.
Mike, how did you get in on the story? How did you start covering it?
The worst possible scenario. I originally covered it for the newspaper. And then one day my phone rang, and it was one of the indicted police officers calling me. And he said he wanted to meet and talk. And so I went out to meet him at a diner in Rockaway, Queens, on the far side of New York City. And it was a rainy night, a terrible night, and it seemed to me an especially rotten time to be alone and know you were going to jail in the morning like this officer was. So I went out and met him in the diner, and he told me his career story, which was a story of frustration and this perverse glory he saw in doing the things he did. And then he ended the conversation with out in the parking lot. He said, "I'll see you around," but unfortunately, he was never seen again. He went to a motel room in Southampton on the far end of Long Island. And the next morning, when the paper came out, he bought the papers and went to the hotel room and shot himself in the head and killed himself. I felt an enormous amount of responsibility for that because I had been used. And in the news business, you're often used, whether it's by the President of the United States or the local postman. Everybody's got a story, and you want to tell that story. But this was beyond the normal course of events. Here was a guy who had a cold-blooded plan to commit what amounted to a murder, his own murder, his own death. And he used someone who was a writer to write his suicide note to communicate the thoughts that he wasn't able to communicate. And then when he saw that it had been done and it was in the paper and his story was out, he killed himself.
It's really, I think, a reporter's worst fear that they're going to say something that's going to... The toughest thing,
you know, it doesn't go away. This story doesn't go away for me. And the other thing is that, you know, the next day the phone rings and you have to go for it again. And cops still call me and I'll still go see them. But in the first few days, it was very tough to make that adjustment.
Well, how did you three get hooked up together, Mike? How did you meet?
Well, this happened with Brian O'Regan, he's the officer who committed suicide. They reached out for me upon seeing the
story. Brian and I were a close friend,
and wanted to know what some of the things he said. And after that, I decided that another thing O'Regan had said to me was, "Why did I do this?" You know, he had asked me that rhetorical question. And with this book and this this work, I've tried to determine exactly why he did do it.
So he called you after the story had already broken, after he was indicted?
Yes. There was a period of time between the point where he was suspended and the grand jury came back with indictments.
I want to talk more about your lives and the story after we take a short break. Let me just reintroduce you first. Just speaking with Mike McAlary, who covered this police corruption story for Newsday and also has written a new book about it called Buddy Boys. And the two people who figure most prominently into this true story are my guests, Tony Magno and Henry Winter. And they're the two cops who were first busted for taking money, and then they turned on the other corrupt members in the precinct. So we'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ask you, Henry and Tony, what it was like to wear a wire when you agreed to cooperate with the authorities, and you were walking around basically with a tape recorder to record incriminating conversations. What kind of prep are you given by the authorities before you go out with the recorder?
Well, the recorder was you talk about prep. We sat in a car one night. It was a dark night after a tour. They handed me a little Olympus microcassette recorder. They showed me the on button and the off button, and they said, "Put it in your pocket." And that's all it was. That's my extent of.
So, which pocket did you put it in?
Well, I changed it.
You're dead if someone finds it, basically.
Yeah. Oh, the thing with wearing a wire on a cop, I said it. I know Tony said it. If we ever caught somebody wearing a wire on us, what would happen? Frank Serpico knows what happened when they just thought he was wearing a wire. We always had the threat of being hurt, especially in the beginning of the investigation. Tony and I were working together most of the time.
That
and
made then, it a little easier.
It made it a little easier.
We were able to talk to each other, and we were able to cry on each other's shoulders in between all this stuff. And then they broke us up, put him into plain clothes, and left me on patrol, and now we're on our own. And that's when you have to really – there was nobody backing you up out there. It was just me and him. And we had to go back into these same drug locations and abandoned buildings. Now, if we were doing something and that recorder would fall out of a pocket, and I'd have to say if one of the officers there saw it and suspected that he was being recorded, there's a good chance you could have been shot in that place.
It wasn't only if the recorder fell out. You know, in police work, policemen get hurt. They fall downstairs. They break their legs. There's car accidents. by splitting us up, if either one of us working with another person would have gotten a car accident and taken to a hospital, and if they had to remove our blouses or our shirts or whatever, they would have found a recorder.
Let me just ask you, I've seen the movies that everyone's seen, and usually, like, if someone's wired in the movies, it's taped to their chest underneath their shirt.
It couldn't
and then there's always the scene where they're sweating so much that the battery leaks acid onto them.
Right.
And they're
it couldn't have been done that way.
Yeah, right. It couldn't have been done that way?
No, because, like I said, we were on patrol and we were changing a locker room.
Oh,
with
sure.
With numerous officers right next to you, and there's no way you could have that stuff underneath your undershirt without it being seen.
This was just done with a common little microcassette tape recorder that you can buy in any Woolworth store.
Henry actually sewed a pocket into the inside of his bulletproof vest and put it in there. And there was also a time when I remember him telling me that he was walking past a storeroom window late at night. And as he walked past, he saw a red glow coming from the middle of his chest. It was the record button.
Yeah, what would happen with the recorder when you pushed it on record?
The little
with all the technology, you know, with everything they have, putting people on the moons. But when you push the record button, a red light comes on.
But the really difficult thing must be to not betray it with your face. Because you know what you're doing. I mean, you're turning on your friends, and you're not feeling perfectly natural.
It was very uncomfortable. Like I said, it was a terrible situation. You know, deep down inside, it was eating your guts up while you were doing it. And, you know, all through the tour, when you had to do something and, you know, somebody was doing something wrong and you were recording them. And then it was a funny thing. You were like a Jekyll and Hyde. You know, after the tour was over, go to my locker, was able to take that recorder off and shut it off. And now the guys were around my locker, were having a beer, talking. And it felt like nothing ever happened. I just loved being with the guys, and it was a real strange situation.
Let me. You had told me before the show started what the tally is as far as what the results of your informing are. A dozen officers resigned from the force because they didn't want to face departmental trials. Four have been convicted in criminal trials. One of the four is out on appeal, and the other three are awaiting sentence. And then one of the officers who was indicted committed suicide, as Mike, you mentioned earlier. How do you feel that on some level this is a good thing that you did, that it's good you broke up? I mean, these are your friends. Your friends, like you, did broke the law. Do you feel like on some level this is a good thing that they've stood trial on it, or do you feel that it's terrible that they did it, but you're glad you did it only to get out of jail? I mean, there's all these different levels here.
Well, the bottom line is we were bad. We did our wrongdoings. The other officers were bad just as well. I feel the 7-7 precinct in Bedford-Stuyvesant was running wild. Somebody was going to get killed. You know, a lot of people could have been killed. I think we did the right thing.
Mike, let me ask you, you've been covering this story and covering other police stories as well. When there's a big story like this that breaks, and especially if it's a story where a couple of cops have informed on other cops and that's what blows the story, do you think that's a good thing in the long run for the police?
No, well, I mean, obviously...
I don't mean good that the cops were corrupt, but
no,
good that it broke.
Well, these guys in this precinct, and Henry and Tony also, to a major extent, they tarnished the badges of everyone that wears a shield in New York City. And I think one of the reasons that this investigation stopped and didn't go on to get more of the people who were doing this sort of thing, and certainly there were a lot more, was because the department said... look, we've washed a portion of our linen. Let's close the case on this and move ahead. You cannot have citizens believing that if they see 10 cops, 4 out of the 10 are going to be corrupt or 2 out of the 10 are going to be corrupt.
Do you think they are, though? Do you think that it's that bad?
Yes, I do.
I do believe it.
Yeah, I think that in the 77th precinct specifically, this would be a low estimate, too, I believe. I believe at least 25% of the...
Even now?
Well, not now because they've all been transferred out. Every cop in that precinct was transferred out. But I would say 10% of the New York City Police Department, the officers, there's officers there that have committed bad acts. And it's a national story in that sense. So you look at Miami, and they've had 100 police officers either indicted or suspended there because of... drug stealing and pocketing of money that goes with the sale of drugs. police corruption is in Boston.
Is a story like this, though, good as a cautionary tale to other police officers that you maybe don't get away with it for too long?
Well, this story is it's a cycle. Everyone said, well, Serpico, it won't happen again.
Right.
But then you had Prince of the City, and now you have this. Mm-hmm. I hate to say it, but in 2 or 3 years, you'll be sitting here with 3 other people, an author and 2 cops who have done the same thing, and it's the same story. People are scared for a couple of years, but then they get brave again.
You know, I have to tell you, I'm really surprised to see both of you, both the former officers, going on an interview tour where you're going to be interviewed on radio and in front of television cameras. It seems to me that there's probably a lot of people who are still pretty angry with you. I don't know if your lives are in jeopardy or not, but it wouldn't surprise me a lot if they were. You're making yourselves real visible.
Our lives have been threatened.
I mean, in organized crime, when somebody turns, they're put into the witness protection program and given a new identity.
The difference with organized crime, cops are a different breed. When you're in organized crime and you commit a crime, you go to jail, you take your time. A cop is a bad criminal. A cop, he doesn't run, he sits home, he thinks about disgracing his family, his kids, and he kills himself. That's what a cop does.
Or he turns.
You're not uncomfortable, Tony, about being this visible while you're talking about the book?
Well, I'm nervous, but like I said before, it has to be told, and the book tells a very good story, and it gives an emotional effect of what can happen to you. And I feel any cop that reads it or knows the story and the emotional end of it might not pick up that dollar bill. Maybe we could help that one cop from doing, you know, stepping over that bound.
Are you still dealing with guilt?
Oh, all the time.
All the time. You know, it's you wake up with it, you go to bed with it, you think of it all the time.
Mike, let me ask you, you told us earlier that you'd written the story about one of the cops and he took his life and he thought he was using you and that story as an excuse in a way for doing it and as a suicide note. But I've only saved you a few seconds for this, but were you kind of afraid to really write candidly about people after that? I mean, did you have to...
Well, you can't be afraid in our business, because the next story is just as senseless or just as violent. And in New York, you're faced with these things every day, and you have to go out and get the story, and you got to try and do it better than anybody, you know, the next person. And if you're going to put parameters on it, you're not going to be successful. You're not going to be worth having on any newspaper staff.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today, for speaking with us. Thank you.
My pleasure.
My guests have been Henry Winter and Tony Magno, 2 former officers who resigned from the force last Thursday. Mike McAlary's book on the police corruption scandal is called Buddy Boys, and that's just been published by Putnam. And McAlary also covered this story for New York Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll feature a live concert performance by jazz clarinetist Kenny DeVern. Here's a sample of his playing.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz singer Sadama B. Benjamin tells how she and her husband, pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim, made new lives for themselves after apartheid forced them to leave their native South Africa. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Leonard Bernstein's most recent opera, A Quiet Place. It's the sequel to Bernstein's first opera, Trouble in Tahiti, which was a satire of life in suburbia. And humorist Al Gingold reflects on a modern rite of passage into adulthood, buying your first couch. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. An American officer serving with the United Nations forces in South Lebanon was kidnapped today. Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins was driving near the port city of Tyre when his car was intercepted. Jim Muir reports.
According to a United Nations spokesman in Lebanon, Colonel Higgins was alone in his UN vehicle, driving behind a similar car with two other observers in it. After going around a bend in the main road a few miles south of Tyre, the two men in the first car noticed that Colonel Higgins was no longer behind them. They went back and found his vehicle abandoned. By all accounts, he'd been intercepted by gunmen, pulled out of his car, and driven off by the kidnappers. The United Nations forces in South Lebanon, UNIFIL, mounted an immediate manhunt using helicopters to try to locate the getaway car. The mainstream Shiite Muslim militia, Amal, which predominates in the area, also joined in the search. Colonel Higgins is one of several American officers serving in South Lebanon with the United Nations Truth Supervision Organization. It mans a number of observation posts near the border to monitor ceasefire violations. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Police in Sunnyvale, California, say yesterday's rampage by a fired computer company technician was set off by a court date on a harassment complaint. 39-year-old Richard Farley is accused of killing seven people and wounding four others at the ESL Corporation. After a six-hour standoff, he surrendered to police. Farley was scheduled to appear in court today to answer a complaint filed by a former coworker who rejected his advances. The woman is one of those wounded yesterday. In Southern California, a dying baby is making history. For the first time in the U.S., a baby born with most of its brain missing has been placed on a respirator so that its organs can be used for transplant. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
About 3,000 anencephalic infants are born each year in the United States. They will all die within hours or days of birth. In the past, they were simply allowed to die. But under a new policy, first adopted by Loma Linda Medical Center, a major transplant center, infants may be placed on respirators so that their healthy hearts, livers, and kidneys can be maintained and used for transplant. Unless a respirator is used, the organs deteriorate and cannot be transplanted. Some medical ethicists question the use of a respirator solely for the purpose of keeping organs alive, but others, including many parents of anencephalic infants, believe the baby should be used to save other lives. At this hour, the anencephalic baby boy remains on a respirator at Loma Linda. His organs cannot be offered to a potential recipient until brain death has occurred. But in no case will the baby boy remain on the respirator for more than 7 days. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
The Oregon Supreme Court ruled today that a motorist arrested on a drunken driving charge must be given a chance to call a lawyer before deciding whether to take a breath test. Alan Saporin of member station KLCC in Eugene has details.
In a unanimous ruling, the court said an arrested driver has a constitutional right to an opportunity to obtain legal advice before deciding whether to take a breath test. Refusing the test in Oregon carries an automatic 120-day driver's license suspension. There is a potential snag in this ruling. Blood alcohol evidence dissipates, so the state Supreme Court said police aren't required to wait a long time before giving the test. But the court did not say exactly what a reasonable time might be. For National Public Radio, this is Alan Saporin in Eugene.
Housing starts fell 1.9% in January. They are now at their lowest level since 1982. And stock prices fell slightly on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 5 points to close at 2,000.99. Declines outnumbered advances by only a few issues on volume of 178 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In 1952, Leonard Bernstein wrote his first opera, Trouble in Tahiti, a satirical view of marriage and suburbia. 30 years later, he wrote a sequel called A Quiet Place. It's his most recent opera. A recording of a 1986 performance of the work has just been released, with Bernstein conducting the Austrian Radio Symphony Orchestra and soloists. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this review.
There's always been a big gap between Leonard Bernstein's music for Broadway and his serious compositions. His Broadway music is so much better. Keeping to a popular idiom forced him to sharpen his tunes, expand his harmonies, tighten his rhythms. The scores to four of his shows, On the Town, Wonderful Town, West Side Story, and Candide, hold up to Gershwin, Rogers, Berlin, and Porter. Bernstein's first opera, Trouble in Tahiti, mixes popular styles with more serious genres. He had the brilliant idea of having what he calls a Greek chorus in the form of a trio of jazz vocalists who comment on the lives of Sam and Dinah, the two main characters, in the style of radio commercials.
Suburbia, suburbia, parks for the kids, neighborly foot chairs, less than an hour by train.
You didn't need to know that these characters were based on Bernstein's own unhappy family. Sam and Dinah weren't really individuals at all. They were stereotypes, Mr. and Mrs. Suburbia. That's what makes them funny, satirical as well as touching. Dinah's desire to break loose becomes most poignant in her hilarious aria describing an escapist South Seas musical, an aria that pokes fun not only at the movies and movie music, but at opera arias themselves.
Olé! They go crazy with the drumming and the chanting and ritual dance, where the lovers sing a ballad of salty romance. It's so lovely, I wish I could think of it. La da 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 da. It was called Island Magic. I think it was. Oh, a beautiful song. I remember it now.
Trouble in Tahiti gets into trouble only when it starts taking itself too seriously. But the element of melodrama that infiltrates Trouble in Tahiti overwhelms its sequel. A Quiet Place begins at Dinah's funeral. She'd become an alcoholic and was killed in a car crash. Junior, Sam and Dinah's son, is having a psychosexual breakdown. He is haunted by incestuous childhood dreams of his sister. Are they really just dreams? His sister is married to his lover. His father has trouble accepting this. At the end, the characters all forgive one another and apparently are going to live happily ever after. It's pure psychobabble, a prurient soap opera whose main interest lies in its own autobiographical exhibitionism. A Quiet Place began life in 1982 as a one-act sequel to Trouble in Tahiti on a double bill. It flopped. So Bernstein and his collaborator, Stephen Wadsworth, have chopped Trouble in Tahiti into two chunks and dropped them as flashbacks into the second act of one interminable three-act opera. It still doesn't work. The satirical pop of the earlier piece is stylistically incongruous with the 12-tone melodramatics, the soupy romanticism and inflated choral hymns that now surround it. Bernstein's unmemorable new music is both corny and pretentious.
Time is never far.
Oh, my God.
Darling, I'm nervous. Give me your hand.
Oh, my God. Is it bad? Who's in the car? A woman.
Look down.
What's left of it? I've never seen anything.
Help me.
The door's open.
It's her.
Who?
At least there are a couple of lively new passages. A bizarre striptease, for instance, that Junior pulls at his mother's funeral. Most of the performances are fine. John Brandstetter as Junior, Beverly Morgan as his sister Dee Dee, and especially Clarity James as the brassy, outspoken Mrs. Doc, allegedly modeled on Bernstein's old friend and enemy, Lillian Hellman. But the only real energy of A Quiet Place, and the best music, dates from 1952, when Bernstein was far cheekier, more inventive, more touching, and more objective about himself than he seems to be now.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new Deutsche Grammophon recording of Leonard Bernstein's opera, A Quiet Place. This is Fresh Air. In the early 60s, jazz singer Sadama B. Benjamin had to leave her country in order to pursue her musical career. She and her future husband, pianist and composer Abdullah Ibrahim, left South Africa for Europe and then the United States. For the past 10 years, they've lived in New York with their children. Sadama's career has often taken a back seat while she raised her children far from her country. Sadama grew up in Cape Town, listening to the music of Duke Ellington and other jazz and pop performers.
I guess that all these things are really deep inside of me, and it's a matter of when you reflect, you know, what shall you sing about? I mean, these things just pop out. or they come to my mind and I say, hey, I mean, I know I can't do them the same way they were presented in the 1920s or the 1930s. And I just think of new ways to do them, or the musicians say, you know, well, she makes everything sound hip.
If you hear a song in bloom, like a flower crying for the dew, that was my heart serenade.
Black people officially allowed to be professional singers in South Africa?
No,
because I know
no.
that you know actors aren't officially allowed to act professionally.
No, that's, I guess, the tragedy of it all. And there's so much talent there, you know. Well, so much aspiration and so such a deep need to really work.
When you were a teenager, did you think, how the heck am I ever going to make a living singing? Why, you know?
I didn't even think that I was going to be involved, you know, as a professional with the music. I trained to be a school teacher, but I was, you know, involved with the singing in the evenings with the church choirs or the school choirs. It wasn't until I was about 19 that I started working in the local nightclubs. And by that, I mean in the white nightclubs, in the white areas. And I could do that weekends because during the week I was by then a school teacher. So, and that's where I got my other sort of jazz repertoire together, because we had the local black so-called colored musicians working there, usually a quartet or a trio, and there was always room for a singer. And they taught me a whole lot.
I'm just a little confused because I know you were able to sing in some of the white clubs. So what did the status change for a while?
It did. And it was 1961. I guess it was just after Sharpeville, you know, the massacre, the Sharpeville massacre. Well, everything just tightened up really, really very much at that time. And there was a lot of unrest. And I guess that was part of the measure, was to, you know, to just keep people in their own areas. It's easier for them to know what's going on when they can keep you in one place. And so we were just denied that. No more black musicians in white areas.
Is that one of the reasons you decided to leave South Africa?
Well, it got really bad. I mean, there was just nothing you could do, no work. I mean, how would you survive? And we met a young Swiss journalist. And he said he was going back to Switzerland, and why didn't we think about getting out of South Africa? And he could try to help getting work, you know, in Zurich. Well, getting out was one thing, is trying to get the money together. We really were starving musicians at that point. I'd even given up the teaching job. The more involved you get, the more, I guess, this kind of music, in it requires that you give it, that you, what shall I say, lay your life on the line for it. It really is true. And with the help of some very beautiful friends, we put on some concerts, raised enough money for two airfares, and went straight to Zurich, Switzerland, in 1962.
Did it feel at all like getting out of prison to live in a country outside of, to live outside of South Africa, where you didn't have
it
restrictions?
It did, you know. These things take a very long time to impact on you. You can't realize it immediately. Immediately you just want to go back home because it's so different, and there's such a culture shock. And then there's the language that you have to deal with. When you take another country's language, you automatically have to pick up something of the culture. To me, there's that real danger that you might pick up something you don't really need.
Oh, I see. And you didn't want to do that.
No, I'm real fierce about that.
You want to be a South African even though you can't live there now.
Well, if not a South African, I wanted to be me, and I wanted to realize who I was, because in South Africa you're told who you are. You know, and someone asked me, well, if you get told from very little that you're inferior because you're black, do you believe this? And I said, of course you do. Of course you believe it. It's all you hear. And it takes a very long time to de-brainwash yourself and then come to a real good feeling about yourself and say, look, I'm a human being. I'm a person and I can do anything I want to do. You know, I didn't know that till like real late in my life.
Well, you went back to South Africa and your children were born in South Africa. Weren't they? Why did you return?
Well, we returned because basically, number one, living in Europe, we were very homesick, and we decided to visit home after 7 years out. And I think we stayed about 3 or 4 months. Because much as we wanted to be there, I mean, things had really worsened. There was no way you could make any kind of political statement. The music scene was much worse than when we were involved and had left. Funds run out, and there's no way to survive there, and we had to leave again. And best place still to go was Europe, because Abdullah always had work there. In 1970, I had my first child.
When, where was that?
Well, we were in Europe, but I went back to we couldn't make it to Cape Town. We got as far as Swaziland. So my son was born in Swaziland, and we spent a year and a half there. And while we were there, we ran a little music school. Again, these things just couldn't... exist because there were no funds. I mean, you just, in the end, you end up against the wall. It's the same story. And for a while, it was New York, it was Europe, back and forth, back and forth. And while I was in Europe, then I got pregnant with my daughter. By then, I was about 40 years old. We were stationed in Vienna. We turned on the television one night and we saw the Soweto riots. I was about 5 months pregnant. I said, I have to go home because now really it's happening, you know. And I went home. But that was a beautiful thing to do because although it was terrifying and, you know, just very horrible in all ways, the strength and the determination of the youth, it gets to you. And we, both of us, I just felt, you know, that after Tzidi was born, we would leave, we would alienate ourselves and make a real commitment so that we would be able to make political statements and never be afraid.
So you decided to move, go to New York, where you'd be free not only to perform, but to speak out about apartheid.
Right. And we got to New York 1977, and she was a couple of months old. And we aligned ourselves with the African National Congress of South Africa and offered our services. And we are still with them because it has a really strong and very long history of nonviolence. It's been there all this time as the backbone of everything else. And let's say we're part of a cultural wing.
Fatima B. Benjamin singing Children of Soweto from her composition Liberation Suite. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
I guess your lead story is the kidnapping of a U.S. Marine officer in southern Lebanon.
That's right. We're trying to get word from Lebanon, but we're also going to have some reaction from the United Nations and some background on this particular United Nations force that Lieutenant Colonel Higgins, a Marine officer, was actually part of. Also, some reaction and follow-up to the victories in the New Hampshire primaries by Vice President Bush and by Governor Dukakis of Massachusetts. And also, in a different kind of election story, perhaps, we have some reaction to the Oscar nominations from Bob Mondello. Big news, not a single American director named for Best Director.
Interesting. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Now humorist Alfred Gingold joins us with some thoughts on a contemporary rite of passage, buying your first sofa.
One day I sat down on our sofa and it collapsed. As I plummeted through layers of frayed fabric, well-tamped upholstery, skewed springs, and wobbly frame, I pondered the sofas in my life. Rickety cast-offs of family or friends, for the most part, of no further use to the original owners and given to me merely as a brief stop en route to the junk pile. They all reached the end of their usefulness in more or less the same way, I mused, descending. By the time my bottom had touched bottom, cushioned by the huge springy dust balls which lurk beneath all my furniture, I'd reached a momentous decision. It was time to go out and buy a new sofa. Suddenly I was filled with the gruesome sense of having passed into a new and dismal phase of grown-up life. Suddenly I was surrounded with options I'd never really considered before, and had no particular interest in now. Do I want a high back or a low back? Curved or straight? Soft arms or wooden arms? Modern or period? If the latter, what period? If modern, how modern? Is postmodern a period or a contradiction in terms? What's the difference between a sofa and a couch? Isn't leather hard to keep clean? Do I want a sleeper? Big question, that. If I don't get one, I'll have no place to put my swinging, footloose friends when they blow in from out of town and need a place to crash. On the other hand, do I really want those freeloaders sponging off me? Why, they probably don't even have sofas of their own just for sitting, let alone one that can unfold for me to sleep on, should I ever blow through their neck of the woods again. Not that I ever will. My rambling days are over, my friend. That's why I'm buying a sofa. That's why my friends are probably snickering at me when my back is turned. He's bought the whole nine yards, they're saying. He's got a sofa. Too bad. He used to be a fun guy. That's what they say now. But it'll happen to them. Sooner or later, we all face the sofa issue. So take heart and take a seat, perhaps on a solid foam rubber sofa, usually about the cheapest sofa you can find, and with good reason. They ooze out from under you as if you were trying to recline on a huge, ill-tempered amoeba. Back sufferers need not apply for these, and by back sufferers, I mean anyone with vertebrae. Then there are futons, those wonders of the Orient, equally unsuitable for sleeping or sitting. Still, they're so easy to roll up and store, especially if you have six arms and the upper body strength of a gorilla. For more conventional tastes and better endowed checkbooks, there are infinite numbers of normal sofas in stores across the land, all in minutely varied shades of beige, all reasonably comfortable, all sort of well-constructed, and all so dull you just want to cry. It's too bad that just about every living room needs a sofa, unless the room has a conversation pit. I wonder whatever happened to conversation pits. Doesn't Hugh Hefner have one? Out of the question for me, I'm afraid. The downstairs neighbors would almost certainly object if their ceiling were suddenly 2 or 3 feet lower. Well then, what about some of those great big pillows? Versatile, colorful, cheap? Who am I kidding? The image of me relaxing languidly on some great big versatile colorful pillows is quickly replaced by one of a fiendishly giggling chiropractor, rubbing his hands as he regards my twisted supine form. No pillows, no futons, no more funny stuff, I'm afraid. When you've arrived in the adult world, you get a sofa. After a trip like that, everyone needs something soft to sit on.
Alfred Gingold's books include Items from Our Catalog, a spoof of the L.L. Bean catalog, and Snooze, a parody of the New Yorker magazine. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll speak with Peter Kornbluh, co-editor of Low Intensity Warfare, a book of essays about our military and intelligence operations in third world countries during times when we're ostensibly at peace. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review The Talking Animals, the new album by singer-songwriter and record producer T-Bone Burnett. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review Shoot to Kill, the new thriller starring Sidney Poitier and Tom Berenger. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Accommodations for Fresh Air's guests while they're in Philadelphia are provided by the Four Seasons Hotel, situated on Logan Square in the heart of the city's business and cultural district. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.